momentarily. Peace and social justice. Bye-bye.
نزرع المحبة تملي قلبي من معاني ونعيش الأمل بشدة ونجعل جنة ذو صحاري
Justice Program. My name is Chris. I am one of a rotating threesome of hosts who bring you guests from all around the country, local, and everywhere the peace and justice struggles are. We are trying to bring those voices to you. And that was the voice of Western Saharan activist. And hang on just a sec. Her name is Aziza Brahim. And that is a video that she made. She is a story unto herself, as many of the Sahrawi people are who stand up against the Moroccan occupation. But I have on the line with me Adrienne Kinney. She is a member of Just Visit Western Sahara and past president of Veterans for Peace. Welcome, Adrienne.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Sure. I just wanted to backpedal just a little bit because before we start talking about Western Sahara, I would like to, as a veteran yourself and as past president of Veterans for Peace, I'd like to get your response to the passage of the PACT Act, which guarantees coverage and care for veterans who have been exposed not only to burn pits, but to a lot of toxic substances, even since the Vietnam War. Can you address that real quick?
Sure. I mean, I know I have worked with veterans when I was previously a counselor and worked in the Vet Center in Vermont, post 9/11 veterans who had been impacted by burn pits. I think that they well deserve the coverage, and the same goes for everybody who's been impacted by toxic substances, et cetera, during their military service. So it's a step in the right direction, and I hope people find it as easy to access the care and get their rights as Congress would have us believe. By passing this act.
Right. And I went on the website, and if you go to va.gov, there's a place where you can file a disability claim. Any of you listeners out there who have impacted people, there is a list of presumptive illnesses there, and it is extensive. So I urge listeners to take advantage of this new law that's been passed. Adrienne, the last time we spoke, it was around Veterans Day, November of 21, and we had just come out of the Afghanistan War, and we would be soon going into the proxy war with Russia over Ukraine. At that time, I didn't know of your interest in Western Sahara, but by February, I had interviewed an author and learned about Western Sahara myself. I interviewed Stephen Zunis, and he is the author of Western Sahara, War, Nationalism, and Conflict Irresolution. And then the next month, I didn't know about your trip until afterwards, but you were part of an international civilian protection volunteer delegation to the home of the Kaya sisters. So first, give us a little history, if you can, of Western Sahara, and then why did you go all the way across the world in order to be part of a civilian protection volunteer group?
Sure. So Western Sahara is a place that, like most of Africa, was colonized by various European powers in the 1800s. And Morocco was colonized primarily by France. Western Sahara was colonized primarily by Spain. And as there was an increasing pressure amongst the United Nations to honor sovereignty of indigenous people and to end decolonize our planet, there was increasing pressures put forth to Europe to get out of Africa. France eventually decided to leave Morocco, and Spain was in the process of exiting Western Sahara when Morocco decided that it wanted to claim that Western Sahara was part of, as well as a few other countries, was part of their historic lands and maintained that they had the right to Western Sahara. Now, mind you, Sahrawi people speak an entirely different dialect of Arabic than anybody else who speaks Arabic, particularly the French and the Moroccan, who were French influenced. So their Arabic languages do not really overlap. Their cultures are different. There are so many differences that you could look to and say, well, this doesn't indicate that Morocco ever had or controlled Western Sahara. The people are very different. So at any rate, in the mid 1970s, Morocco started sending people in to occupy Western Sahara, essentially people, settlers. And the Western Saharans have tried many times to gain their independence and right to self-determination, but have been pushed back against by Morocco. And many times this has been at the behest and the support of the United States, who deems it has a special relationship with Morocco and has been supporting Morocco's right to claim and control Western Sahara. So in 1990, the UN brokered an agreement. There was supposed to be, when Spain left, and this was in the mid-1970s, there was supposed to be a referendum during which the Sahrawi people could vote their future. And that was delayed and delayed and delayed. In 1990, the UN said again that they wanted to push for the referendum, but that never happened. And there are evidence that the United States helped to stall perpetually this referendum. So the Sahrawi, there are many who are living in exile in refugee camps in Algeria. From everything I have read and heard, and a lot of this is informed by Stephen Zunis's work, is that the refugee camps there are a testament to people organizing for and taking care of themselves under extraordinary circumstances. So there's so much that I could go into, but essentially what you have is Morocco claiming control of a country that it has no right to claim control over. And, you know, Morocco does not have the best reputation in terms of supporting humanitarian rights. There's been horrible humanitarian rights suppression in Western Sahara. And essentially, that is one of the reasons why there was a call from Sahrawi activists within Western Sahara for intervention.
Adrian, are you still there?
I am, yeah.
So at that point, you you heard about this and you decided that you were going to go as, were you part of Nonviolence International at that point? Or how did you end up going?
It's kind of a very simple yet complicated history. One of the organizers who was helping to get this civilian protection delegation together is a member of Veterans for Peace and knew that I knew Arabic. And so he reached out to me and basically asked if I would help with some translation. To be honest, at the end of last year, I didn't know anything about what's going on in Western Sahara. So I got a request to help with Arabic, and I was like, this would be a good opportunity for me to practice my language skills. And so I said yes. And as the weeks went on, I learned that that what this would actually entail, it wasn't to be just translating documents or conversations, but accompanying others to Western Sahara to demand the end to the siege of the Khaya family home. So Sultana Khaya is an incredible human rights defender, which is important to name her that, because with that title becomes a lot of UN protected rights. But what Morocco had been doing is they had sent police forces and other occupation forces, and they had surrounded her house and had been occupying Boujdour. They essentially occupy most of Western Sahara. They limit movement of travel. They have checkpoints set up on the roads that check documents repeatedly, like maybe every 10, 15 miles. And basically, it's to limit the freedom of movement of the Sahrawi community. And they had a siege on her home. They wouldn't let people into the home. They had gone into her home and trashed it. The things that the Khaya family had gone through are just, it's just deplorable. They had unknown substances injected to them. Their well, they had said that somebody had poured substances into their well. When we got there, which we had to go by unusual means, in order to get there, because Morocco has such a history, long history, of denying anybody the right to enter Western Sahara, to include the UN Human Rights Special Rapporteur, who was denied entry. Lawyers of Sahrawi activists have been denied entry. Journalists have been denied entry, and or if they gained entry, have been kicked out. There's just a long history of denial of access to Western Sahara, and we were able to get there. The house smelled of chemicals. The well water smelled like, I would say, nail polish remover, mm-hmm. like an acetone-y, horrible smell. All of the furnishings were removed. Light fixtures were removed. The sisters were beaten. They were raped in front of their mother. The Moroccan occupation forces, they have these clubs with nails in the end that they would routinely use to beat and harass people, and the nails being there to cause excess damage. When we got into the house, It's interesting to think about that, because there was just so much stress and anxiety and commitment. At one point, before our arrival, the Moroccan occupation forces had gotten access to her roof and blockaded her roof door in order to prevent her. One of the things Sultana did while her home was under siege was to go to her rooftop and wave the flag of Western Sahara and demand the rights of Sahrawi people. And so they barricaded the door shut so it couldn't be opened from the inside. And so she got tools, whatever she could get, and made a hole in the wall so that she could access her roof. And when we arrived, within a few hours, the community, what we've been told is that the Moroccan occupation forces left the area. They withdrew to figure out what had happened and what had gone wrong. And when that happened, the community realized they had the opportunity to gain access to the house. And that was about 10 days, 2 weeks. We got to climb through the wall that she had made to access the roof, and would go up and just be there in community with Sultana and her family in the community. And, it's unfortunate. There are so many things that are just unfortunate, but what you can't plan for everything. What we didn't realize was that when the Moroccans, they didn't come into the home after we were there because they didn't want us to be able to report on what they were doing in the home. Instead, they began attacking women in the community who had visited the home. Children who had visited the home were arrested and detained. There were six women who were attacked over Easter, Passover, and Ramadan weekend. One had her virtually all the bones in her hand broken by Moroccans who told her that she would never again hold a Western Saharan flag. This is just, it's brutal and ongoing.
Yeah.
And it demands attention. One thing that they've been very good about is ensuring that no story of what is going on in Western Sahara gets out. And that's why virtually nobody knows about what's going on in Western Sahara unless they really want to know.
Okay, let me stop you there because there's a couple of things I wanted to say. I wonder, number one is that Amnesty International was in there in May of 22, and they have corroborated the disappearances, beatings, torture, arbitrary detention for those who stood up for human rights. And also, as far back as 2018, Democracy Now! Was able to get in there. You can see a segment on that, listeners, on Democracy Now! In August of 18, and it just gives you a small amount of information, but it's basically the same thing that my guest, Adrienne Kinney, is talking about. And you yourself, I guess, went back and were deported in May. Is that correct?
Yes, I was going to take a relief team of two other civilian protection delegates who had volunteered to go and relieve the two delegates who had been there. They were there for 2.5 months. The two people who I originally went with. And we were able to go to Morocco. We got on a plane to go to Bouzdour, Western Sahara, and we arrived. We had guests waiting for us. And the Moroccan occupation forces, they denied our entry and forcibly put us on a plane back to Casablanca. And they said we were entitled to stay in Morocco, but we were not allowed to be in Western Sahara.
Okay, so Morocco annexed Western Sahara in 1975, so they're very established in terms of taking the resources of the country. But 85 nations have recognized its independence. However, both Democrats and the Trump administration have stood by Morocco in illegal annexation. And the big problem here is that Trump formally recognized Morocco's illegal annexation, and even the maps have changed, and Biden has done nothing to reverse that. And what can you tell us that we could be doing in terms of the United States' role in this?
Well, number one, I think that the United States needs to stand by the universal rights, human rights, and self-determination, period. And number two, that would just be, there's only one number, that the U.S. should stand up for human rights and the right to self-determination, period. And by gosh, that honestly would cover so many things right there. And you're right that Trump's declaration recognizing Morocco's right to control Western Sahara did kind of ignite Morocco's forcible control. I think it probably upped the ante. The Sahrawi activists in Western Sahara have have tried to stand up so many times, to include at the beginning of the Arab Spring. There were reports of tens of thousands of Sahrawis gathering in Laayoune, the capital of Western Sahara, until they were forcibly dispersed by Morocco. So the Biden administration, they have failed to put Western Sahara back on the map. They have failed to reopen their consulates and their offices that had direct communication with Western Sahara. And it just, to me, it's like the United States wants to have everything their own way. If Russia does something, which they illegally invade the Ukraine, and the United States is all up in arms against it, but Morocco here is illegally occupying Western Sahara with the blessings of the United States. And the hypocrisy is astounding and confounding.
Right, and I had wanted to get to that because in Ukraine, we're fighting a proxy war that could lead to nuclear war, which could destroy the planet. So every show I do, I want to address the need for to stop funding that war and shipping weapons. And I'm pretty sure you agree with me, but we're out of time just about. And I want to make sure that we promote your work. There is now a Just Visit Western Sahara network of groups and individuals committed to peace and justice, protection of human rights, respect for international law, all of which have been denied to the Sahrawi people. And so you're encouraging people to go there and see the beauty of the place and to see the reality of the occupation. Can you just end with your pitch for us to get more involved, Adrian Kinney?
Yeah, I mean, I frankly think that that Western Sahara, their right to self-determination being recognized, would be a huge step forward for us understanding what human rights and humanity and the right to self-determination really means. And their commitment, the Sahrawi commitment to peaceful protest for their rights, is something we could all learn for. So, you know, going back to Veterans for Peace United Kingdom's line, violence is not the solution to the problems we face in the 21st century, whether it be open war, proxy wars, or brutal occupations. And if people want to travel there, that's wonderful. Go through the Canary Islands. There are flights from the Canary Islands to Dakhla and to Laayoune. Or you can travel there by just learning more about it.
Okay, and the web, and you go to, if you want to be part of a delegation, info@justvisitwesternsahara.org. And that's a project of Nonviolence International. Adrian, I want to thank you so much for being on the Peace and Justice program again, and also for drawing that connection with Ukraine. I appreciate that. Do you have any last words about the war in Ukraine? Because I can give you another minute.
Yeah, I mean, I think that war is an instrument of diplomacy. There has to be a better way in the 21st century, not only for people, but for the planet. War and militarism are two of the greatest destroyers of our planet, wherever it happens. And it's just nowhere. It's not a way human beings should be interacting with each other in the 21st century. So I hold people everywhere, the Ukraine, Western Sahara, Palestine, everywhere that where they are being oppressed and brutally treated, if not killed. Yemen, I mean, there are so many, too many places, but there's also so many people working for peace and social justice that it gives me hope.
Right, me too. And I want to thank you for your work, and I hope that you'll come back and join us again. I want listeners also, if you get a chance, my guest is Adrian Kinney, and she has also petitioned the United Nations, the Special Committee on Decolonization. Western Sahara is the last colony, so we would like it to end. And so thank you so much, Adrian Kinney. I appreciate you very much.
Thank you. Likewise.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Okay, I didn't say that well, but hopefully you understood what I meant. And so this is the Peace and Justice Program. My name is Chris, and we're going to have our next guest up here in a minute, but I wanted to see what announcements I brought with me. And we're going to be talking about reproductive justice next. And so I just wanted to encourage you to be involved locally and show up. There is some work being done by a group that I'm part of called WORD, Women on Reproductive Defense, and they recently participated in a national conference that I located the guests that I'm going to have on next, and it was incredible. And so being part of a larger group is how you can find out what's going on, how you can keep yourself from becoming depressed by the information that is overwhelming us. And I urge you to get involved. Let me know if I can turn you on to anything that we talk about. And GSEC, the organization, Gender Studies Organization at Chico State, is sending a representative to the Women's March Chico chapter. Well, it's Women's March, actually. Women's March Chico is sending a representative to a women's convention in Houston, Texas this weekend. And this is a wonderful time for people to come together to build community and to learn more about how to face the coming crisis that we are in, that is rolling out as we speak in terms of abortion. And I think you all know that we lost our right to reproductive health care with the Supreme Court decision on June 24th, which overturned Roe v. Wade and Planned Parenthood versus Casey. It's called the Dobbs decision, and we'll be talking about that with the next guest. So let me go ahead and do my underwriters, and we'll get her on the line, okay? All right, so we want to thank everybody who supports KZFR, but also our underwriters. So in this case, it would be Patrick Riley, a real estate professional with Century 21 Selects, specializing in properties in Chico and Butte Meadows. Patrick is dedicated to helping buyers and sellers achieve their real estate goals with kind, quality service. Patrick can be reached at 588-6593 and on Facebook, and by Cast Hope, giving kids the gift of the outdoors through fly fishing by hosting a comedy night dinner with Tom Papa at the Sierra Nevada Big Room on Saturday, September 24th. Besides Tom's 20-year stand-up career, he's also an author and has a Netflix special. For tickets to Tom Papa at the Big Room, visit casthope.org, and there will also be a silent auction and raffle, all benefiting kids in the outdoors. Also want to thank the ARC of Butte County, serving individuals in our community with autism, Down syndrome, cerebral palsy, and other developmental disabilities. Learn how you can become an ARC advocate at arcbutte.org. Helping to support over 1,300 individuals and families throughout the greater Butte County. The ARC, more than just a thrift store. And lastly, the Bankruptcy Law Offices of Michael O. Hayes, a proud supporter of community radio. Michael O. Hayes offers complimentary consultations and payment plans for Chapter 7 and 13 bankruptcies. For more information, visit chicobk.com or call him 530-892-8916. So it's noon straight up. This is FM 90.1 KZFR Chico. Listeners supported community radio for the Sacramento Valley, the foothills, and beyond. The opinions voiced on the program do not necessarily represent the views or opinions of KZFR, its staff, board of directors, underwriters, or volunteers, just my own and my guests. And so with that in mind, let me put some music on for you. Okay, so we started off the show with the Sahrawi music, and this next one is Linda Allen singing the news, celebrating 50 years of singing the news, and the song is I Choose. So here we go.
Parking lot, pushing through the screaming faces, staring at her blue shoelaces. She's at the clinic door, with our bodies and our voices. No one takes away our choices. Sing it loud and clear so everyone can hear. You don't get to choose. You who do not know my story, you don't get to choose. You will never own this body, what I hold or what I lose. I choose.
Linda Allen, I choose. And I have on the line with me a really special person. Her name is Rocky Gonzalez. She's an accomplished and experienced nonprofit leader and executive. She's an anti-racist organizational development consultant with extensive project and team management experience. She's an expert facilitator, trainer, and professional coach with decades-long history of grassroots community organizing and activism. Her unique experience and approach is rooted in intersections of her identities. She's indigenous Latinx, queer mother with an ancestral legacy and connection to the land in the south of Texas and north of Mexico that is called Borderland. Her leadership is democratic, relational, compassionate, rigorous, and holds accountability in relationships as a central key to success in any project, organization, or team. She lives through the lens of intersectional, with a base of indigenous knowledge and teachings of her spiritual and cultural practices, Danza Azteca, and Native American Church. And she is also the founder and board chair of the Frontera Fund and the deputy director of the Austin Justice Coalition. Welcome, Rocky Gonzalez, to the Peace and Justice Program.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, I was able to attend, well, I didn't attend it, I watched it afterwards on YouTube, of Operation Save Abortion. And there were 25 panelists and 60 partner organizations, and I think people all over the country participated in this. And you were on a couple of the panels, and it just was so striking to me about not only your presentation, but the depth of your involvement there in Texas. And I know for myself as an abortion advocate that I've been watching Texas for years and the struggles of your state and this and the activists there. And one of the stories you told on Operation Save Abortion was about 2013, and at that time, you had 40 clinics in the state, and the state legislature wanted to do a 20-week ban on abortion, and they wanted to strictly restrict doctors from practicing medicine. There was a struggle. Long story short, it was passed, and then the Supreme Court overturned it in 2016, and then at that point you had 19 clinics in the state. But tell us a little bit about what it was like in Texas in 2013 when you and so many others stood up against this repression.
Oh, I love that question. Thank you. So back in 2013, people kind of most, understand or remember that time as like the people's filibuster where Wendy Davis at the time, did an all-night filibuster inside the Texas Capitol. That was kind of like, I think one of the things that like mainstream media really wanted to focus on. But the truth of the matter is that there were thousands of people who were showing up to the Texas Capitol during that legislative gathering every day in droves, just thousands of people. And at the time, we were not sure what exactly was going to happen. It seemed like one of the most restrictive anti-abortion projects that we had seen, right, at least in our lifetime. And, I learned, from talking to a lot of, elders who've been in the movement for a long time, that, obviously, these things have, been, coming and coming and coming, right? Like in Texas, we really just haven't made a lot of advancement or progress when it comes to reproductive rights and, in particular, access to abortion. But what we were looking at was this, you know, SB 2, I believe it was then, was this bill that, like, it was going to require that all clinics have ambulatory surgical centers, which means that the hallways in the building have to be, you know, some specific amount wide. It has to have certain types of facilities in there, like an operation, like an ambulance center, right, like an operation room. And the truth of the matter is that most of our clinics are tiny little, spaces that actually don't require all of that kind of equipment or space, right? So this is like a tactic to, like, you know, shut it down. And the bill was full of other things, too. And so, you know, at the time, what we decided to do, I was part of a women of color-led collective called Rise Up Texas, and we just started organizing people. We started holding assemblies on the lawn of the Capitol, and we started training people in how to do direct action safely. And we spent about 2 weeks just kind of living at the Capitol day in and day out, executing just different kind of tactics. So we were inside all of the, like, chamber rooms where they were, you know, like, the different special committees were meeting, and, you know, we'd go in and we'd disrupt those and make sure that, you know, got on the media, and when they were, you know, meeting, you know, in the kitchens and in the lunch areas or whatever, we were there to do direct action. And, you know, we held funeral processions, and we held rallies, and we held, you know, all kinds of just creative ways to make our presence known. And I think one of the most beautiful things about that moment in time was that I met hundreds of people, and so many people who had never been to a protest before, who had never, you know, had lived mostly, like, you know, apolitical lives, and this threat to reproductive rights and to reproductive justice was strong enough to bring Texans from all over the state to rally out and to speak out against, you know, this anti-abortion legislation. The night that the first vote took place, the night of the filibuster, we filled the Texas Capitol, which is, I believe, the largest capitol in the country, largest state capitol in the country, massive building, with this, you know, sort of rotunda, like, round structure at the center of it, with 4 or 5 floors with balconies looking over, which means that you can stand on the ground floor of the Texas State Capitol and look up to the other 4 or 5 rotundas going up. And we filled all of those spaces, just filled them packed with people. And we sang and we shouted and we chanted, and we were so loud inside the chambers that at the end of the night, I think it was getting close to around, you know, midnight at some point, and they actually had to close the session. It was the last day of the Texas legislative session, and they had to close it without passing the bill because it was so loud inside the Capitol that they could not hear one another to record the vote. And so that was a huge win for us, and it was a demonstration of, you know, what people power can do and what happens when folks are, you know, outraged enough to show up, and when we, you know, organize that outrage into something productive, right? The legislative, you know, folks did end up calling a special session to hear HB 2. Because they were unable to vote on it at the end of that, like, the official last day of the session then. They called a special session, and they did go ahead and pass it. And we had, you know, the numbers. People came out again during the special session to interrupt the vote. In that moment, at that time, it became really visible, like, the division between, you know, what we were seeing at the time was you know, largely white-led national and state organizations and people of color-led organizing and movement, you know, folks, because they had, you know, some folks had organized a rally outside the Capitol, and we were trying to get people inside the Capitol back again to interrupt the vote. And folks who were just kind of showing up to participate didn't know whether or not they should, you know, be outside at the, you know, rally with the speakers that had been organized, or if they should be inside the Capitol, you know, raising hell with us, where we had a sit-in outside the chambers. Our governor brought in hundreds of DPS officers from the Department of Public Safety, officers from across the state, bussed them in specifically to, like, stop the direct actions and whatnot from happening. And in the sit-in outside of the chambers while they were taking the vote, you know, they, you know, put a couple of our comrades in the hospital and kind of, like, used aggressive force to push people outside, to push people outside and to get us out of the Capitol. And we stayed as long as we could. And some of our people were hurt. And, you know, it was passed. And as you mentioned, later challenged and overturned by the suit that Whole Women's Health brought. But ever since then, we have been seeing an increase of, like, audacious anti-abortion legislation be put forward. And it has taken the overturn of Roe v. Wade for mainstream Dems to finally stand up and say the word abortion and to be loud and proud about defending abortion. Now we have elected officials saying we really need to defend abortion access, and the federal government is doing something about it. And it's really wild to see that it's taken this sort of drastic moment for folks to finally be willing to stand up and defend abortion. And so there is a silver lining here, and we hope to take advantage of it and to continue to fight back against the total abortion ban that we now live under in Texas.
Right. And, you know, I just did a segment on colonialization in Africa and the Western Sahara, and this feels exactly the same thing when you were describing what the people were going through in the rotunda there. So, listeners, reproductive justice is a human right to maintain personal bodily autonomy, have children, not have children, and parent the children we have in safe and sustainable communities. That is a definition that we can probably live with, all of us agree on. And in Texas, you know, part of what Texas keeps driving the discussion. In 2021, the Texas governor signed SB 8, which banned abortions as early as 6 weeks of pregnancy. And then the Congress stepped up to pass the Women's Health Protection Act in September, which passed the House but then didn't pass the Senate. And when you look at this, Rocky Gonzalez, when you look at this broad overview of what the United States is doing, do you have a sense that more people are registering to vote, that people will be taking that tact also?
My sense is that yes, and it's because of the youth, right? Like younger millennials and folks younger than millennials are outraged, and they have this ability and this access to call their government and the authority out. And I see a wave of an active generation that I really haven't seen in my lifetime. You know, I'm like borderline Gen X and millennial, and there's always been a lot of apathy. You know, when I was growing up. In the youth culture, but Gen Z is doing it. They're showing up in droves, and they're really making a difference. And so I expect that we will see much higher numbers of voter registration. And I also expect that more people are going to be turning out to vote in Texas, because one thing about restricting abortion access has just been like tradition in the Texas legislature. Like every session, you know, they throw something anti-abortion. They take any opportunity they can to ban abortion. And that really hasn't, you know, inspired, you know, great mass of, you know, change or new like voter engagement or anything like that. Whereas Roe v. Wade has. And back in April, my organization, Frontera Fund in South Texas, led a campaign to free a woman who was incarcerated and given a $500,000 bail, half a million dollar bail, been charged with murder for her pregnancy outcome, and we were able to successfully like campaign to get her out and have her charges dropped. But had that arrest happened now, I think the state would be looking very hungrily to prosecute. And so, you know, now what we're looking at is how do we take the outrage of people who saw the direct impact of anti-abortion legislation in their small communities? How do we take that, like, realization that they're having, like, oh, like, this isn't just a political issue that, like, my family doesn't talk about in our conservative community. You know, this is, like, this could be my sister. This could be, you know, someone I know. This could be a loved one, you know, going to jail for murder under these laws.
Right.
And so now people are kind of waking up to the reality of what this could actually mean for them and their communities. And I think we're seeing a wave of change, and I think that we're seeing a lot more people get, you know, active and involved. When we did Operation Save Abortion a couple of weeks ago, there was over 10,000 attendees live during that feed.
Very
exciting. Which is incredible. And, you know, the folks who attended from Texas comprised thousands of them all over our state, not just in the urban cores like Austin, Houston, San Antonio, Dallas, but, like, all over Texas. And so we're really seeing a kind of awakening and an inspiration, you know, of people who are ready to fight for abortion in a way that they really never have been. And so that, in combination with Dems and elected officials finally, you know, being willing to stand up and say abortion, I think bodes well for us. It means a lot of work, but we're, you know, we've been preparing for it for years. So that's, you know, on to the next step. We'll just keep doing what we do and, like, elevate what we do to a different level. And, you know, I think that this really is going to create a lot of commotion in Texas.
And you had anticipated this or been in the right place at the right time, I guess, but the Frontera Fund is so needed now. And I was wondering if you could tell us about your organization and abortion access funds for the probably hundreds of thousands of women that are going to be needing it until legislation or new Supreme Court or whatever needs to happen in this country to get women their rights.
Well, that is one of the things about SB8, is that organizations like Frontera Funds have been forced to cease operations. What we do now is considered criminal.
Oh.
So the language of SB8 about aiding and abetting abortion really is, you know, a direct hit at abortion funds, because that's what we do. We aid and abet abortion, right, in a good way. And because our mission is really centered around funding abortion and getting people, you know, what they need to, like, either travel to another state or actually just pay for the abortion care itself, or the ultrasounds that, you know, were previously required when abortion was legal here. That's what we did. We helped people, you know, cover those costs and meet the logistical and practical needs of traveling to get an abortion. And now we have been forced to cease operations as an organization, right? Like, individuals are allowed to, you know, make their own, they're autonomous and make their own decisions. But as an organization, as a 501c3 nonprofit organization, we are in a pause and looking to our work right now is, like, how do we pivot what our mission is and be able to continue to work in our lane without incriminating or getting, you know, putting into danger our staff or our board or volunteers, because that's the, you know, that's the danger, right? And Texas is looking to set some precedents. They're coming, you know, we are being heavily surveilled right now. Frontera Fund and other abortion funds like us in Texas have already had Petition 202 filed against us, which means that people are preparing for litigation to sue us, and they're looking for any cause. You know, we've been instructed to not leak documents and things like that, because they're just going to be looking for anything. And the kind of base of that is that, you know, we had Texas went, they closed for COVID, and they said that only essential medical health care facilities could stay open. Our governor used that opportunity to ban abortion. So at the height of COVID, abortion was banned for a moment under the essential healthcare only rule. And, you know, then that was undone. And then a little later on, we had SB8 And, you know, between the time the SB 8 passed and the injunction that was filed to allow us to continue funding again, there's that window. And so they're looking like, you know, we've had all these other, like, mandatory ceases of operation because of these laws and these things that they keep trying to pass. And so they're coming after us, and they're looking to prosecute. They're looking really hard, and they have a lot of resources to find a way to stop what we're doing and to decriminalize us. They want arrest and they want prosecution on the books. They really want to validate, you know, what they've done here. But we've got elections coming up here in November, and we've got a lot of like hopeful momentum here in the state. We have worked to pass a couple of municipal, city level, ballot initiatives and ordinances that decriminalize abortion, because in Texas, cities and municipalities have the right to self-governance. So, you know, we had about somewhere between 5 and 7 district attorneys across the state have committed to not prosecuting abortion, quote-unquote, crimes. We have a few cities now, I believe we're at 4 cities, Austin, San Antonio, Dallas, and Denton, who have passed local abortion decrim measures, and we're working to expand that. And you know, it's an ongoing battle, but like I said, we have a lot of, renewed and new support, for our fight. And so that's the focus right now. And so abortion funds are not going anywhere. We're just on pause. We're figuring out the next move, but outside of Frontera Fund and Lolo Fund and Teeth Fund and, Fund Texas Choice and the Bridge Collective and all of the other abortion funds that we have in Texas that are paused right now, outside of that, there is movement happening, there's organizing happening, and we are pushing these municipal bills, and in about 2 weeks, we're going to be announcing a new project that really focuses on decriminalizing abortion and regaining and expanding access to abortion in Texas.
Wow, you know, I don't know why it didn't get into my thick head that you would not be able to use your funds, you know, or collect. But there is funding available, listeners. Abortionfunds.org through the National Network of Abortion Funds. And that is a way you can contribute, and also the way that that clients who need health care can get funding. And then there is also, if there's legal problems for people, there's reprolegalhelpline.org. So, and Rocky Gonzalez, we're going to run out of time. We are out of time, but how can people follow you? How can people keep a finger on the pulse of what's happening in Texas? It seems, it does seem that you are very endangered there. And I just want to be able to support you, you know, if and when the Texas decides to prosecute the people who are on the front lines of the struggle for reproductive justice.
Oh, that's great. Thank you so much. So currently, for like security reasons, I've retracted a lot of like social media, but over across my public Instagram is where folks in the next 2 weeks will see announcements of the new project that includes lots of abortion funders and other advocates, abortion advocates from across our state. And so folks can follow me there, and in the next couple of weeks, they'll be able to see all of the different organizations and coalition partners that we've brought together to launch this new project. And that Instagram handle is Arcanum, ArcanumXVIII.
Oh boy, I didn't get at that, but hopefully you'll text it to me so I can put it on the KZFR website so that people can follow up. And it is important right now that we stick together and that we support one another going out across this country. And for those of us in California, very important for you to know that we're going to have a proposition on the ballot that would protect reproductive rights in California. So November 8th is register to vote if you're not registered, because you are needed to keep abortion safe and legal in our state also. Rocky Gonzalez, thank you so much for being you and for the work that you do in this world. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. Have a great rest of your day.
Thank you. Bye. Okay, so I am so so sorry that I was so dense that I thought that the Frontera Fund could help women in Texas, but obviously they are being criminalized also for aiding and abetting. And also, you know, we're worried about restrictions on self-managed abortion, too. I mean, you know, one of the things that Rocky brought up in when I saw her online was getting rid of some of the stigma around abortion. Don't use that coat hanger thing anymore. You know, there are abortion pills available for women. You can't be more than 9 weeks of pregnancy. That's by last menstrual period dates. So you have to use them super early in a pregnancy. But they are available. The FDA has not restricted them from online use, and there are many programs to assist you in getting having the support you need in order to have an abortion by telehealth, basically. So I'll try to put some links on the website, but these are dangerous times for our humanity as people with uteruses. All right, so I'm going to shift gears again. I have a great segment coming up that Bill Mash produced for us by about legend Bill Russell, who died recently. He was the coach of the Boston Celtics. I always want to say Celtics, but I know that's wrong. Anyway, coming up there is, I wanted to let you know that for Smart Growth Advocates, that it's trying to protect our foothills, there's going to be a fundraiser coming up, and that is Monday, August 22nd, 7 p.m. at the Center for Spiritual Living at 14 Hillary Lane. Doors open at 6:30. Concert starts at 7. It'll be Keith Greninger and Stevie Coyle. So it's going to be a really great show. And I can't give you the price of the suggested donations, but let's see, where can you get the tickets? You can learn more about Smart Growth Advocates at smartgrowthchico.org. You can pay at the door. And it's also on Eventbrite, Save the Foothills concert tickets. Okay, so let's go on to our recorded interview that Bill Mash did, and I'm going to give you a little segue music here, and then I'm going to get that on. Actually, don't even need the segue music, but let's have a little moment here, and then we'll go right to that. This is Sweet Honey.
Before the day you left, I did not know if I could take two steps out of my front door. Before the day you left, I did not take a breath. I did not inhale. I think I was almost dead. You make me wanna live. Don't think I even cared. I wandered aimlessly. I was so unaware. I heard news of destruction. I did not even cry. If someone called my name, I would just pass them by. You make me wanna live. You make me wanna try. You make me since you've been gone. It was just like a dream. I still can't feel it now. I'm still in disbelief. I know you won't come back. I know somehow you're here. I tried to settle down, not live my life in fear. You make me wanna live. You make me wanna try.
One of a two-part series honoring the life and times of Bill Russell. William Felton Russell, born February 12, 1934, died July 31, 2022, had his number 6 Boston Celtics jersey permanently retired across the NBA yesterday. At first in the 76-year history of the league, Russell was most famous for being the winningest champion in United States major sports history. He won 11 NBA titles in 13 years, 2 NCAA basketball championships, and an Olympic gold medal. He was also the first African-American head coach of a major professional sports team in the modern era. His endurable basketball accomplishments tended to overshadow his humble civil and human rights advocacy that culminated with him being honored with a Presidential Medal of Freedom in 2011. As Bill Russell says, "I had made up my mind that I would not become the bigot stereotype of the Negro. I would not be the laughing boy seeking their favors. I would just be me." As a lifelong Boston Celtics fan, I'm keenly aware of Bill Russell's persona of respect and justice for all. Bill Russell stood with Muhammad Ali, walked with MLK, and rests among the giants of our time. He was a man who walked the walk with joyful sorrow and sorrowful joy. Boston itself was a flea market of racism. It had all varieties, old and new. The city had corrupt City Hall crony racists, brick-throwing send-them-back-to-Africa racists, and in the university areas, phony radical chick racists. Other than that, I like the city. Bill Russell. The intent of this part one segment is to introduce and reacquaint our listeners with the incalculable impacts Russell had in every space he occupied. We start with a radio edit of the official National Basketball Association In Memoriam video published on August 1st here on Peep Bot Radio.
Russell grew up in Monroe, Louisiana, before his family moved west to Oakland, California. He was told early that when challenged, he should never back down.
When we first moved into the projects, and these 4 kids ran by, and one of them slapped me as he's going by, I went upstairs and told my mother, and we went all through the projects looking for those guys. And you're gonna fight every one of them one at a time. It was 5 of them. I lost 3 and won 2. And so I go home, crying, and she says, "Don't cry. You did what you had to do."
As a teenager in Oakland, he would blossom into a star at McClyman's High School and go on to play close to home at the University of San Francisco. His defensive abilities were unprecedented.
And there's a fight for the rebound. Taft recovers and he can move. Russell blocks his shot and the Dons are showing their power.
Russell led his school to back-to-back NCAA titles and would cap off his amateur career by winning Olympic gold in Melbourne in 1956. Heading into the NBA draft that year, Red Auerbach of the Boston Celtics understood that Russell could transform his team. Just months after Russell joined the team, the Celtics were champions.
The all-around play of the Celtics is too much for the Hawks to overcome. Boston down St. Louis to win the NBA's World Series for the first time and become the professional basketball champion.
Russell would soon be joined in the league by another dominant force, Wilt Chamberlain.
The winning is only important if you beat the best. My friend Wilt, Norman Chamberlain, was far and away the best player I've ever played against.
Throughout the 1960s, their rivalry would become a centerpiece of the NBA game and captivate audiences. Over the years, it also became one of mutual respect. Wilt's statistics were astounding, but Russell kept collecting championships.
Right after he got in the league, folks were trying to compare us. I decided that I will never change the way I play for the Celtics.
Starting in 1959, Russell would lead the Celtics on a still unmatched run in American team sports. 8 consecutive lead titles.
Bill Russell, 30 points and 40, I repeat, 40 rebounds.
Russell used to become physically ill before every ball game.
I mean, that's how much each particular game meant to him.
West all alone, look at Russell come down. And what a play by Russell!
Was it important to dominate? Yes. It was important to dominate because one thing that you want to do to your opponents is to make them think, make them know they can't win.
we shut a guy down or block a guy's shot and say, yes, we did that to you. If you come back, we'll do it again.
That's it. It's all over. It's all over.
Everybody in the place is yelling and screaming. They deserve it, John. They're the greatest basketball team that was ever assembled.
But even as they dominated throughout the 1960s, Russell and his teammates also had to battle the degradations of racism. One such instance took place before a preseason game against the St. Louis Hawks, scheduled to be played in Lexington, Kentucky.
Casey went down to the restaurant in the hotel we were staying, and they would not serve him. We decided we weren't going to play.
Russell helped lead a boycott of African-American players from both teams. Russell's sense of justice extended beyond the world of basketball. He also sought to make a difference in society at large. After civil rights leader Medgar Evers was murdered, Russell flew to Jackson, Mississippi to help oversee the integration of youth basketball games.
Well, do you think that you will get some white kids to play basketball with Negro kids?
I think so. I don't see why not. My kids play with white kids, and nobody got hurt yet.
When heavyweight champion Muhammad Ali refused to fight in Vietnam because of his religious beliefs, Russell joined America's finest African-American athletes to support him.
When we had the summit in Cleveland to see how Muhammad Ali felt about going into the Army, Bill was right there, and with no fear.
There's so many things that he contributed by how he lived his life, how he dealt with his success, and the pride that he had. You know, we needed examples of people with pride.
Jackie Robinson was a hero to all of us. But my attitude was that Jackie took us from point A to point B. I was not going to revisit point A. I was going to start at point B.
By 1966, the Celtics had established themselves as a dynasty. As the legendary Auerbach stepped down, Russell was on the verge of making even more history. With his hiring as Celtics head coach, Bill Russell broke through a long-standing barrier and had to face his share of doubters.
As the first Negro coach of a major league sport, can you do the job impartially without any racial prejudice in reverse?
Yes.
How?
Because the most important factor is respect. And basketball respects a man for his ability, period.
Russell would grow into his role as player coach. After a playoff loss, the Celtics recaptured the crown in 1968. The following season, the Celtics were an aging team and found themselves fighting again for an NBA title, but this time as underdogs against a powerful Los Angeles Lakers team that had just added Chamberlain to its roster. It was only fitting that for these two longtime foes, the series would go the distance.
I can't help but wonder, how do you feel about going into another seventh game, this time on somebody else's floor?
We've done it before.
We get back up. Well, the last game, Jack Kent Cook was the owner of the Lakers. He put out a sheet in all the seats. When the Lakers win the championship, the balloons in the rafters would fall down, and Chick Hearns would interview Elgin Baylor, Jerry West, and Wilt Chamberlain in that particular order. Well, I took this back to Russell.
Sam showed me that, and I said, well, a couple of things. It is humanly impossible for the Lakers to win the game tonight. The Lakers can't beat us. But it's going to be fun to watch them get those balloons out one at a time.
Naturally, Russell walked away from his final game a winner.
Chris, I'm here with Bill Russell. Bill, this must have been a great win for you. I know, it's hard to say what's in your mind right now, Bill, and it must have been a great win.
Well, this is such a great bunch of guys, you know, and it's just been so fabulous the way they played for me, and it sounds all corny, you know, start talking like that, but I told these guys before the game, I don't care what happens. I wouldn't trade you guys for any guys in the world.
Russell would play in 10 NBA Game 7 playoff matches in his career, winning them all.
Bill Russell was a champion on the court, a powerful voice for equality, and a heroic example for all who followed.
A few young people here, they'd like to be president of the United States. You can do anything that you want to do, if you want to do it bad enough. Thank you very much.
Bill Russell, the man, is someone who stood up for the rights and dignity of all men. He marched with King. He stood by Ali and made possible the success of so many who would follow.
For the game's ultimate winner, Russell's legacy lives on through the NBA Finals MVP Award, which bears his name.
I've never wanted to live my life to get accolades or honors or anything. I've tried to live my life doing what I think is right and for the right reasons. And I think that I did okay.
This is Bill Russell's last video recorded before his death, congratulating Stephen Curry for winning the NBA Finals MVP, named in honor of Bill Russell.
Steph, congratulations on your first Bill Russell MVP award. I wish I could be there to give you the award myself, but I'm glad I could share this message with you regardless. You're a great person and player. Congratulations to you and your team. Have fun.
Bill Russell was an outstanding storyteller with one hell of a life experience to share. The Civil Rights History Project from the Library of Congress and the Smithsonian National Museum of African American History and Culture interviewed Bill Russell in May of 2013. The 3+ hour video interview is deeply insightful, raw, and personal, like the man himself. Here is a 12-minute portion of it here on Peep Bow Radio.
You see, when I was a kid in Oakland, in elementary and junior high school especially, Oakland had a major minor league baseball team, the Oakland Acorns, who played in Emeryville. Well, we used to go out there. We couldn't afford to go in the park. And we wait and see if anybody hit a home run. You could take that ball and go in and get in. But we found that the worst creatures to ever invade the earth were minor league baseball players. They would come out of the games and they see us and they call us the N-word, spit tobacco at us, and act indecently. So my view of professional athletes was not positive at all. So when I went to an exhibition game, the Lakers were playing, and this guy that went to, yes, if I want to, he played high school ball with Jim Pollard, who was a big star with the Lakers. He said, "You want to go to the locker room?" I said, "No, I don't want to go there with those people." You know? And so I said, "I'll wait out here." So he goes in there. And so while I was waiting, George Mackey comes out. He sees me and he walks over me. "How you doing, big fella?" Well, that was a real joke. Mackey was 6'10", 280. And I was 6'7", 100. And he says, "How you doing, big fella?" He said, "You play center?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "Well," he showed me a couple of moves that he used. I says, "Now listen, when you get out of college, you got to come play for the Lakers." Now I could even make my homeroom team. And college was, I had no scholarships or nothing. And so I'd been working at a shipyard to save enough money to go to college. I couldn't pay my own way. So Mike says, "After you get out of college, you got to come play for the Lakers." And that was he was the number one guy in basketball. And he talked so nice to me. He wasn't condescending or anything. He was talking to me like I was another ball player.
Well, that's going back more than 50, 60 years or something like that. And we think race relations would have been horrible back then, but and they were, because you've never been rosy about it. But you're saying that even back in those periods, there are always exceptions to the rule. This is a
well,
really
you know,
white
remember
guy.
I told you his folks thought he was going to be in the cemetery.
Yeah.
And but he was just a good person. And I tell you, one of the greatest rewards I had was after George died, they had a private ceremony for his family. And I was invited. Because George and I had been friends. You know, we had a thing in L.A. We did a TV show or something. And George says, Bill, I want you to do me a big favor. I need a big favor from you. I'll understand if you said no. I said, what is it, George? He said, I want to introduce you to my son. Are you kidding? That's a favor? You know. So he introduced me to his son. And he says to his son, I want you to meet Bill Russell, the greatest son that ever played basketball. And I said, George, people forget. You know, he won 3 championships in 5 years. He was the man in basketball. But it wasn't on television and all that, so most people didn't know that. But I was so flattered that this man had been so nice to me. You know, a lot of people say very, very insensitive things to kids. And I hope that I never do that. Well, I have this thing that I get along. Let the first thing out of your mouth be your second thought.
Because the first one is the one that might injure a kid.
Yeah, or even you.
Yeah. I think one of your sayings was always that you don't believe there's any such thing as other people's kids.
Right. Well, I was speaking at a school in Fort Worth, Texas. And they were winding down the Vietnam War. And I said, instead of spending all that money killing peasants, we should take that money and repair our educational system because we haven't paid enough attention to it. And we haven't paid enough money to it. And so after the speech, one guy comes to me and says, well, listen, your speech was all right except for one thing. What you talk about is raising my taxes. And why should I pay taxes to educate other people's kids? And I said to him, 2 reasons you should pay taxes. One, when you were 6 and your folks bundled you up and sent you off to school, there was a school there for you to go to. And your folks did not build it. It was there. And second, there are no other people's kids in the United States. That's the next generation of Americans. And if we don't educate them, we'll lose all the things that we think are important. Because if we're not one of the top educated societies, we will not be able to compete internationally. And so we have a choice of either building our schools or picking a war. And I don't think picking a war is the best option.
Could you talk a little bit about your relationship to the civil rights movement? I know because that was during your playing career, it was around for a lot of it. I know once you went to Mississippi in the summer of 1964 for Charles Evers, the brother of Medgar Evers, a year after he was killed?
Well, you know, I was never big on organizations. Mm-hmm. And the reason for that was, if you say something as part of an organization, you can be dismissed as a mouthpiece for an organization. And so they don't have to deal with what you're saying. When Medgar Evers got shot, we had a memorial service for him in Boston, at the Boston Common. And I sat next to Charlie Evers, his brother. And so, I don't know what I was thinking. But I told him, there's anything I can do, here's my home number. He used it. So he called me that summer and says, we've taken a hit. Morale-wise. And we're down the lowest we've been. And so we need somebody to give us a boost, to show somebody from outside cares. So I said, okay, what do you want me to do? He says, well, you know what would be a good idea, right in your field of expertise, why don't you do some clinics, basketball clinics, in Jackson, Mississippi, and surrounding towns? Invite everybody. Any kid that wants to come can come to your clinics. I said, I can do that. So I went down and did clinics. And I actually enjoyed myself. And and Charlie says to me, you know we're not going to let anything happen to you. I said, okay. And so I had armed guards. I'll tell you, but they were like the Secret Service. You never knew they were around. But that gave me such the high.
That was 1964. This is Mississippi Freedom Summer. Werner, Cheney, and Goodman, the first three civil rights workers on the very first night, were murdered. It was a frightful place to be going to.
Yes.
And you're not exactly inconspicuous.
Well, you know, I was invited years later to the McDonald's High School All-Star Game, okay, in Indiana. And so I went there, and I had a good time. And after I spoke, they asked me to take a picture with each one of the participants, boys and girls. It was a boys' game and a girls' game. So while there was the female high school player of the year, was a young lady from Colorado. And so she was, while they were setting the picture up, she says, Mr. Russell, I'd like to say something to you. You said something today in your speech that I will carry with me for the rest of my life. What? She said to us, do not be afraid. Because all decisions made out of fear are usually bad decisions. And you go into a new world from high school to college, into college into the world. Do not be afraid, because you already, you got this far. Do not be afraid. Well, I may be not too bright, but I cannot recall the last time I was afraid. And the society I live in, every time I can do something, I see it as an opportunity.
Guillermo Mash back in the KZFR studios with awe and reverence for the wisdom, words, and laughter of the late, great Bill Russell. I urge our listeners to stream the full Civil Rights History Project interview with Bill Russell via tinyurl.com/RussellCivilRights. Until the next time, always remember, if you have a roof, be grateful.
Hi, this is Asia Shiraga with the Torres Community Shelter and True North Housing Alliance. We'd love to invite you to come to Blues and Brews, a live concert benefit for the Torres Shelter, on Sunday, August 21st from 1 to 7 p.m. at the Chico Women's Club in downtown Chico, featuring Big Mo and the Full Moon Band, Stump Jumpers, and the Unknowns. You can find out more at truenorthbutte.org, and you can also get tickets at the Music Connection in downtown Chico. Be sure to bring some cash.
It's time for the KZFR 90.1 FM Community Calendar with me, Mark.